West Point was shattered, and André was dead. The danger to the Culper Ring was still very much alive. "I am happy to think that Arnold does not know my name," Townsend noted in a letter to Talmadge. Clearly, Townsend was anticipating what all of the covert operatives must have been dreading, that Arnold would disclose the identities of any spies known to him in order to keep himself in the good graces of the British. Woodall sent a letter, dated October 26, in which he explained to Talmadge in Washington, "I have this day returned from New York, and am sorry to inform you that the present commotions and watchfulness of the enemy at New York hath resolved Culper Jr. for the present time to quit writing and retire into the country for a time. Most certainly the enemy are very severe, and the spirits of our friends very low." Just as the confusion of the Arnold betrayal began to dissipate, a blow was struck that threw all covert agents into a state of fear once again. Woodall wrote to Talmadge on November 12 of some disturbing news. "Several of our dear friends were imprisoned, in particular one that hath been ever serviceable to this correspondence. This step so dejected the spirits of Culper Jr. that he resolved to leave New York for a time." The letter goes on to add that Austin Rowe had returned from New York and that Brewster had narrowly escaped capture while crossing the Sound. There is no indication that Rivington was ever suspected or that his newspaper operations were suspended, and the Ring's satellite members who had functioned as couriers all seemed to be safe. The person imprisoned enjoyed very close ties to Townsend, making it likely that the ever-serviceable friend apprehended was none other than Agent 355. Whether she was found out and betrayed by Arnold or caught because of general suspicion, the lady's capture shattered the morale of the other five spies. Townsend's spying activities largely ceased during the season of his withdrawal from business. Washington took advantage of the time to shift his focus temporarily from Manhattan to the surrounding areas. Thanks in part to the reports still coming in from Woodall on Long Island, Washington began to reconsider Talmadge's earlier proposals to storm certain vulnerable locations on Long Island. On November 21, 1780, Talmadge, now a colonel in the Continental Army, led a contingent of 80 men selected from his 2nd Dragoons, along with Caleb Brewster, who was listed as a captain in the operation, from Fairfield, Connecticut, across Long Island Sound in whaleboats to the town of Mount Sinai, roughly 6 miles from Talmadge's native Setauket. Battling rain and high winds, they marched roughly 20 miles through the night of November 22, straight across the island to Mastic on the southern shore, and attacked Fort St. George on the morning of November 23. Constructed and fortified the previous year by staunch loyalists, and named for the patron saint of England, the fort had a large stockpile of supplies and provisions, including an ample amount of hay upon which British soldiers in the area depended to feed their livestock. After a brief fight against the well-armed residents, Talmadge's men were able to seize control, destroy the stockpile, burn the hay, and take the fort's inhabitants prisoner, all while suffering only one injury on their side. The prisoners were marched back across the island to the boats that were waiting under guard, and the whole company crossed the Sound again for Connecticut. Washington was pleased by the efforts and applauded Talmadge in a personal letter. Woodall, too, sent his congratulations, writing on November 28, "The burning the forage is agreeable to me and must hurt the enemy much." It was not a major battle from a strategic standpoint, but it delivered an important morale boost to the Patriots and provided a psychological victory over the British by proving that New York and Long Island had not been forgotten, nor were they invincible. Part 4. Chapter 36. Closing in on the Ring. The Culper Ring stayed busy, if not active, in spying, as the calendar turned from 1780 to 1781. Late in the winter, Caleb Brewster captured a British boat and took 8 prisoners, including 2 officers. Townsend resumed his business and reopened his shop in the city in March. Woodall tried to persuade him to start gathering intelligence again. Townsend believed that the British had dispatched a spy of their own in New York, who was actively trying to root out the sources and paths of the Culper's information, and he insisted on lying low. The matter was dropped until the end of April, when Talmadge could finally report the pending resurrection of the Ring's activities, with a few adjustments made to their former routine. The plan which he, Woodall, has consented to adopt on certain conditions is for him to remain for the most part on Long Island, and Culper Jr., whom he thinks might be engaged again, to reside constantly at New York, he wrote to Washington on the 25th. That some confidential person must, of course, be employed to carry dispatches, as it would cause suspicions which might lead to detection if either of the Culpers should be frequently passing from New York to Setauket, etc., they being men of some considerable note. Washington preferred a more timely delivery of intelligence, but he agreed to this arrangement. The Culpers' reports were essential to the continued success of the Americans, even if they did take a few days longer to arrive. However, Townsend adamantly refused to put pen to paper. He had seen how André had been done in by the discovery of papers and plans, hard evidence he could neither deny nor talk his way out of. He would be happy to convey orally whatever information he had observed, Townsend explained to Woodall when they met in the city in early May, but the risk of trying to smuggle written documents out of Manhattan was far too great. Chapter 37. Rivington delivers Yorktown. General Washington remained hopeful that the next major military engagement would be focused on retaking New York, but he was depending heavily on the French Navy, which was currently in the Caribbean. The success of the mission would rely in large part upon the men, supplies, and ships that the French could provide to support the inadequately manned and provisioned American forces. When word reached the general that the fleet would be sailing in August 1781 to Yorktown, Virginia, and not to New York, he was disappointed, but knew he could not afford to squander such an opportunity. Hoping to confuse General Clinton, he left 2,500 men north of New York and arranged for a fake invasion of Staten Island. Then he set out on a hot summer march to Virginia. Because the British had ample warships and the Patriots had none of their own, Washington longed for intelligence about the codes the British used to communicate among their ships, so he could determine their orders in advance and inform the French. Whether someone had left a copy in Rivington's coffee house or the British had commissioned him to print more is not clear, but somehow he managed to procure the entire British naval codebook. Rivington passed it on to Alan McLean, an independent intelligence agent. Both McLean and the codebook made it safely down to Virginia by the end of the summer, and Washington was able to transport the book to the French admiral by mid-September. In French hands, it was a more effective resource than the Americans could have dared hope for, and its loss was more devastating than the British could have imagined. Chapter 38. The Beginning of the End for the British. The Siege of Yorktown was a roaring success for the Patriots, thanks in no small part to the codebook, which allowed the French to anticipate nearly every movement of the British fleet. Despite his continued assurances that he would send reinforcements to Virginia, General Clinton failed to deliver, paralyzed by the fear of leaving New York vulnerable to attack. Trapped by both land and sea, the British general in Virginia, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Cornwallis, was unable to muster the power to break through in either direction. He could not attack, he could not retreat. A white flag was the only option. He surrendered, on October 19. To military leaders on both sides, the events at Yorktown made it clear that the conflict was reaching its natural end. The Americans had stood their ground and doggedly fought for every inch of land they deemed rightfully their own. The British government was finally recognizing that superior military muscle was not enough to make the determined Patriot Army back down, especially when they had powerful allies on their side. On March 28, 1782, word reached New York from London that the House of Commons had voted to end all offensive strikes in the American colonies. Loyalists in the remaining British strongholds of New York, Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina, who had been certain of coming out of the war on the winning side, felt betrayed by the crown. Facing an uncertain future, they began to make plans. Should they stay and rebuild their lives, or should they emigrate back to Europe or northward to British Canada? The majority of loyalists, like the majority of patriots, were humble men and women of modest means. Small landowners, tenant farmers, laborers in the cities, fishermen and longshoremen along the coasts, hunters and traders in the frontiers of the Appalachian Mountains. In deciding where to live out the remainder of their days, they had to take into consideration the inclinations of their neighbors and their own consciences. It would not be a pleasant thing to be forever regarded as the neighbor who fought against our government. Some of the wealthiest citizens had already booked passage back to England. Now the common folk began to do the same. Chapter 39. Townsend's Last Letter. Townsend had firmly declined to commit anything to writing back in May, but during the long summer, he could see the shaky position of the city and knew that Washington needed the best intelligence he could offer in order to calculate the next, and maybe final, move of the war. Townsend shouldered the responsibility of delivering the latest report himself, figuring that if he was arrested and tried as a spy, he would have only himself to blame. The message Townsend delivered to Talmadge, with the date September 19, 1782, written across the top, is the final surviving letter from Culper Jr.'s hand. The news painted a city in upheaval. The last packet, so far from bringing better news to the Loyalists, has indeed brought the clearest and unequivocal proofs that the independence of America is unconditionally to be acknowledged. Nor will there be any conditions insisted on for those who joined the King's standard. It is said that an expedition is now forming at New York, and by many conjectured to be against the French fleet, etc., at Boston. A number of British troops were embarking when I left the city on the 14th and 15th instant. But I conversed fully with one of Carleton's aides on this subject, who told me that I might depend they were bound to the West Indies or Halifax. For my own part, I have no expectation that they think of any offensive movements. The above gentleman, with whom I am most intimately connected, informed me that it is now under consideration to send all the British troops to the West Indies. Sir Guy himself says that he thinks it not improbable that the next packet may bring orders for an evacuation of New York. A fleet is getting ready to sail for the Bay of Fundy about the 1st of October to transport a large number of refugees to that quarter. The aide above referred to informs us that he thinks it probable he shall go there himself. Indeed, I never saw such general distress and dissatisfaction in my life, as is painted in the countenance of every Tory at New York. The beef contractors had orders a few days past to cease purchasing any more for the Navy, and from the appearance of things, the whole fleet are getting ready for a movement. I am myself uncertain when the troops will leave New York, but I must confess, I rather believe if the King's magazines can be removed, that they will leave us this fall. Townsend's prediction of a British evacuation before the end of 1782 proved a little too optimistic. Finally, on February 3, 1783, The government of Great Britain formally acknowledged what were once its American colonies as the independent United States of America. Chapter 40. And a Reckoning. Woodall continued to send the occasional report from Long Island, though there was nothing of great urgency or importance anymore. The culpers had done their duty and done it well. A note dated July 5, 1783, was accompanied by a final balance record that Woodall submitted to Talmadge, at the major's request. "I only kept the most simple account that I possibly could, for fear it should betray me, but I trust it is a just one, and I do assure you I have been as frugal as I possibly could. I desire you would explain to the general the circumstances that attended this lengthy correspondence, that he may be satisfied that we have not been extravagant." Woodall then concluded the letter in a way that clearly reflected the present optimistic mood on Long Island. "Wishing you health and happiness, I am your very humble servant, Samuel Culper." After 5 years, four major plots thwarted, countless misgivings and close calls, and untold sleepless nights, the Culper correspondence came to an end. The ring had operated effectively from the very heart of the enemy's headquarters and had never been successfully infiltrated, uncovered, or unmasked, despite numerous efforts in that vein. The loss of Agent 355 was a tragedy, but it was also remarkable that the casualties were not much higher, given how close the culpers were to the enemy in Manhattan and the daring maneuvers of the agents on Long Island. While the spies had not been able to deliver Manhattan to Washington before the war's end, they had been his eyes and ears there, enabling him to beat the British even without holding the city. The Culper Ring was a success. All that remained now between Washington and his spies was the settling of some small monetary debts, the larger debts, the intangible kind, for helping to protect a fledgling nation, could never be fully repaid, nor did the remaining members of the Culper Ring seek out such payment. A return to an open, honest, and simple life in an independent nation founded on their native soil would be reward enough. And so they hoped and prayed and waited for the British to depart from New York at long last, even as the aftermath of war swirled around them. Afterward. Retaking New York. The British delegation finally signed the Treaty of Paris on September 3, 1783, and Washington's troops were at the ready to ride into Manhattan as the last redcoat left the city. Colonel Talmadge, however, was concerned for the safety of his spies who had lived and worked as loyalists during the occupation. Knowing they might now find themselves threatened by their newly empowered patriot neighbors who had no inkling of their true sentiments and bravery. How could Townsend erase the fact that he had run a store that served British soldiers, worked for a loyalist newspaper, frequented the coffee house popular among the officers, and kept company with those who had penetrated the inner circles of the top brass in the city? From the view of someone on the outside, Robert Townsend had not only enjoyed a rather cushy life during the war, but also profited from it. This would hardly sit well with those who had suffered the loss of life, limb, and property for the sake of American independence. And Colonel Talmadge was fearful that some vengeful patriot might come looking for his pound of flesh. He was desperate to seek out his spies and contract bodyguards to ensure their personal welfare, send them underground, create for them yet another false identity elsewhere in the city, or even spirit them out of New York for a time until passions cooled. Talmadge received permission from General Washington to go into Manhattan to meet with his spies. By all accounts, he was able to meet quietly and safely with Townsend and the others to ensure their security when the British finally evacuated the city. "While at New York, I saw and secured all who had been friendly to us through the war, and especially our emissaries, he wrote. At noon on Tuesday, November 25, 1783, coincidentally Robert Townsend's 30th birthday, Washington rode into Manhattan with Benjamin Talmadge among the officers at his side. A contingent rode ahead, scanning the streets as the last of the British officers boarded their ships. Washington followed with his officers and troops spanning eight across. In the previous days and hours leading up to that moment, some joyful patriots had hoisted American flags over their homes, only to have them torn down. In a few cases, they came to blows with redcoat enforcers. But now the citizens of New York, no longer subject to British law or British soldiers, waved flags freely as Washington rode forward. Church bells tolled, not in warning, but in celebration, and the shouts after each firing of the cannons were triumphant rather than terrified. Some people even crowded the water's edge, waving at the ships set for departure, and laughingly bidding the defeated soldiers on board a lovely trip home. Washington's trip to Long Island. He never knew their names. In 1790, Washington, now a civilian, made a tour of Long Island to meet the people and examine the damage done to land and property during the British occupation. But he also had it in mind to privately visit with and thank the individuals who had risked so much to gather intelligence and smuggle it to him. He approached Setauket on April 22 and made a stop at the house of a Captain Rowe, which is tolerably decent with obliging people in it. Whether those obliging people with whom he passed several pleasant hours included the rest of the Setauket culpers, Benjamin Talmadge, Abraham Woodall, and Caleb Brewster, or whether he was even aware that he was lodging under the roof of one of those very spies he had journeyed to thank, Washington did not say. His knowledge of the ring members' true identities was, after all, purposely quite limited. He had not wanted to know more than he needed to, in order to protect them, and several of the members, Townsend in particular, had been insistent that Washington never learn their names. The following day, he took his leave of Rose Tavern and continued eastward, where his tour took him to Oyster Bay. His brief notes make no mention of a meeting with Robert Townsend or any member of his family, despite Samuel Townsend's numerous run-ins with the law and his suffering as Colonel Simcoe's reluctant landlord. Had Washington been aware of the debt of gratitude that he owed to a certain native son of this town, his stay surely would not have been so brief. Instead, he made his visit, paid his respects to the brave citizens of the town, and rode on, having never met the man he so earnestly sought to thank. By the time the president crossed the ferry back to Manhattan at sundown on April 24, he had completed his circuit around the part of the island wherein lived the ring of spies who had served him so faithfully and carried out their weighty task with dedication and courage. He had sincerely hoped to have some time with the mysterious Culper Jr., who had risked his life, health, and well-being for so long, passing in and out of the lion's mouth every day, seeking to still the monarch's roar within American borders. But no matter the greetings sent the general's way or the invitations extended, Townsend never stepped out of the shadows to meet with his commander in chief. It would have been a great honor, to be sure, but it was not one that Townsend sought. He did not want praise or celebration. The greatest reward Washington could give him was simply a return to a quiet and unassuming life, as a man subject now to no king but God. Those few who knew the Culper's secret kept it close, and all Washington could do was carry gratitude in his heart for the sacrifices of his brave spies, which were no less meaningful for having been made in city streets and country backroads rather than on a battlefield. These men and women had given their all to, as the preamble to the United States Constitution states, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Appendices. Post-war lives of the Culper Ring. Caleb Brewster, after his years of excitement rowing back and forth across Long Island Sound in his whaleboat and engaging in hard-fought skirmishes, found that the second part of his life was much quieter than the first, though he was never far from the sea. He married Ann Lewis of Fairfield, Connecticut, in 1784, and moved to a farm at Black Rock, southwest of Bridgeport, Connecticut, where the couple had several children. Brewster passed away at his farm on February 13, 1827, at the age of 79. For all of his prodigious feats of bravery and skill during the war, his headstone notes his eventual rank of captain and then sums up his service simply. He was a brave and active officer of the Revolution. James Rivington had a less tranquil retirement. Rivington and his shop received special protection in the days and weeks following the British evacuation from New York City. There would be no burning and looting, as had occurred at the hands of the Sons of Liberty in 1775. He remained in New York, though his newspaper business suffered because of his reputation as a staunch enemy of the New Republic. He was eventually forced to close his shop, and with 8 children to support back in England, several bad investments, and a personal taste for the high life, his financial situation deteriorated until he served time in debtor's prison. He died in New York, where he had spent 36 of his 78 years of life, on July 4, 1802. Austin Rowe, like Caleb Brewster, achieved the rank of captain and carried that title proudly for the rest of his life. He and his wife, the former Catherine Jones, had 8 children. In 1798, the family moved from Setauket on the northern shore of Long Island to Patchogue, almost exactly opposite on the southern shore, and opened a hotel. Unlike many of the other Culpers, Rowe enjoyed sharing stories of his spying adventures with locals and patrons at his inn, though he was careful to protect the privacy of his fellow ring members. He passed away on November 29, 1830, at the age of 81. Benjamin Talmadge married Mary Floyd, daughter of Major General William Floyd, a signer of the Declaration of Independence. The couple moved to Connecticut, where they had 7 children. In 1792, Talmadge was appointed postmaster for the town of Litchfield. He would later serve 16 years in the House of Representatives, 1801 to 1817. Talmadge died on March 7, 1835. He was 81 years old. Robert Townsend never spoke of his service, never applied for a pension, never corrected those who assumed he had done nothing but tend his shop during the war, and never, it seems, recovered emotionally from the blow of Agent 355's capture and imprisonment. After the war, he grew even more reserved and reclusive, staying near his brothers and their families, but never marrying himself. Townsend developed strong abolitionist beliefs and staunchly opposed any type of slave ownership. Later in life, he worked on behalf of some former slaves of his father's to help them gain their freedom. The man once known as Culper Jr. died exactly 3 years after Benjamin Talmadge, on March 7, 1838, at the age of 84. Abraham Woodall married Mary Smith in 1781. He lived in Setauket for the rest of his life, where he raised 3 children and served in various senior positions in the Suffolk County government. He never spoke much about his role in the spy ring. He passed away on January 23, 1826, at the age of 76, and was buried in the Setauket Presbyterian Church graveyard. In 1936, the Mayflower chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution erected the following marker near his simple headstone. Friend and confidant of George Washington, head of Long Island Secret Service during the Revolution, and operated under the alias of Samuel Culper Sr. To him and his associates have been credited a large share in the success of the Army of the Revolution. Born in Setauket, October 7, 1750, in the original Woodall homestead, son of Richard Woodall and Margaret Smith. Fifth generation from Richard Woodall, the original grantee of a large portion of Brookhaven Town. He was a Presbyterian occupying a pew of authority in the old church, and doing much toward the building of the new church. Was a man of integrity, punctual and precise in his business relations. He freed his slaves long before they were legally free. Filled numerous important positions, being magistrate in Setauket many years. Judge of the Court of Common Pleas 1793 to 1799. First judge of Suffolk County from 1799 to 1810. Agent 355, whose name and fate have both been lost to time, might have escaped imprisonment and gone on to live a long and happy life. Or she might have passed away somewhere in the dark, disease-infested hull of HMS Jersey. When the British left New York in November 1783, they abandoned the Jersey in the harbor, with several thousand starving prisoners still on board. Washington's time as a spy. 2 decades earlier, in 1754, the British Army, consisting of both soldiers from the motherland and local colonial militias, had launched a war in North America against the French army and native tribes who were attacking British citizens in regions granted in previous treaties to the British government. For the next 9 years, the continent was embroiled in battles to control the various outposts and forts sprinkled across the wilderness regions of the Ohio River and Appalachian Mountains. The previous year, Washington, just 21 years old, volunteered to engage with the French soldiers and learn whatever he could about their intentions and fortifications through leading conversations, as well as whatever was carelessly shared over wine bottles. As it did throughout his life, Washington's temperate nature served him well on that mission, as he maintained his sobriety and clear-headedness so that he could report back to his superiors that the French had no intentions of quitting the country without a fight. The significance of the Culper Ring. As set up by Washington and Talmadge, the Culper Ring had several advantages over other spy rings, and its success helped shape intelligence operations for years to come. First, they had an added layer of security. Not every member was aware of the identities of the others in the ring. Second, the Culpers had developed a complex network that allowed Woodall, Brewster, or Rowe to add intelligence en route to General Washington, confirming or correcting the initial reports so the information was more detailed when it finally reached its intended destination. Third, the Culpers were able to operate in a wide social circle because the members were citizens from all walks of life. Townsend gathered information from soldiers around the city and sailors at the dock. Agent 355 charmed strategic details out of high-ranking officers at parties. Rivington repeated gossip and plans overheard in his shop. Woodall enhanced these reports with his own observations of troop activities on Long Island and recounted what shop owners were saying, or if there was an uptick in lumber sales or ship repairs. Rowe learned whatever news was shared when tongues loosened in his tavern, and from the water, Brewster spied on British naval movements. Communicate in secret. Use invisible ink. Invisible ink was widely used in Europe and the colonies in the 1700s. George Washington knew this and asked a chemist friend to take the technique one step further. He asked for an ink that could only be made visible using a secret stain. Then the ink and the precious stain were delivered to his spies. Washington's spies wrote messages in invisible ink between the lines of ordinary letters, reports, or store inventory lists. If captured, the papers would not raise any suspicions. When the spies were being especially careful, they wrote a message on a blank sheet of paper and slipped the sheet into a pile of blank paper. But they had to let the receiver know which sheet of paper had the message on it. Sometimes they folded a corner, but that could easily be detected. So they made a tiny mark or dot on the sheet with the message, sometimes on the back so it was hard to notice at a quick glance. You can communicate using invisible ink too. You can write messages on paper that will seem blank, or write your messages between the lines of sentences written in pencil or pen. Lemon juice, milk, and onion juice make good ink. Milk and lemon juice are easy. Onion juice is smelly and harder to make. For lemon juice ink, cut a lemon in half and squeeze the juice into a bowl. For milk ink, simply pour milk into a bowl. Onion ink is made with a three-step process. Cut the onion in half, grate some of it carefully into a bowl, and let it stand until you see liquid gathering in the bottom of the bowl. Write your message on the thickest white paper you can find. Your writing instrument can be the end of a chopstick, a toothpick, or a cotton swab. Think of your message in advance because it's sometimes hard to see where you have already written a word. Make sure you let your invisible ink dry completely. Now let's see if you can expose what you've written. For lemon juice and onion juice messages, pass the paper carefully over the top of a toaster that has just popped up. Be sure to wear oven mitts while doing this. For milk messages, you'll need to rub graphite over the paper. The lead in pencils is graphite. You can get some from a pencil sharpener drawer, or you can ask an adult to scrape some off of a pencil. Rub the graphite very gently over the paper, and your message will appear. Use an alphabetical code. The first code that Benjamin Talmadge set up is called an alphabetical code. He opened a dictionary to the first page and started to make a list of all the words he thought would be important in gathering information about British actions. Words such as artillery, lumber, ships, supplies, and troops. The dictionary helped him think of all the possible words. He wrote them in alphabetical order and then assigned each one a unique number, starting with the number one. Then he added people's names and places to the list. In the end, there were 763 words in his code, each with a unique number. This kind of code is usually used by inexperienced spies, because it is easy to decode. If the enemy figures out that a message is in this kind of code, they could figure out that numbers close together might start with the same letter. They might also know that smaller numbers, in the 20s and 30s, for example, would represent words at the beginning of the alphabet. The code for attack was 38, and that larger numbers, such as 700, would begin with letters at the end of the alphabet. The code for wagon was 703. There are many other ways to make up codes and send messages. These three books have lots of ideas. Blackwood, Gary, Mysterious Messages, A History of Codes and Ciphers. New York, Scholastic, 2009. Yanechko, Paul B., Top Secret, A Handbook of Codes, Ciphers, and Secret Writing. Cambridge, Mass., Candlewick Press, 2004. O'Brien Eileen and Diana Riddell. The Usborne Book of Secret Codes, London, Usborne Publishing, 1997. Timeline. 1765. March 22. England passes the Stamp Act, levying a tax on every piece of paper the colonists use, newspapers, legal documents, bills, and even playing cards. August. The colonists secretly found the Sons of Liberty to organize protests against the Stamp Act. 1768. October. British troops land in Boston to squash the rebellious colonists. 1770, March 5. A clash between patriots and British soldiers in Boston becomes known as the Boston Massacre. 1773, Spring. James Rivington establishes his print shop in Lower Manhattan and begins publishing his first newspaper. December 16. The Sons of Liberty dump tea from merchant ships into Boston Harbor to protest 13 years of increasing oppression. 1774, January 16. Abraham Woodall inherits his family's homestead in Setauket, New York. June 2. The British pass the Quartering Act of 1774, which requires colonists to provide rooms and meals to British soldiers. September 5. The First Continental Congress meets in Philadelphia with representatives from the colonies. 1775, April 19. The Patriots and the British fight at Lexington and Concord, firing the shot heard round the world. The Siege of Boston begins. May 10. The Second Continental Congress meets in Philadelphia. June 15. George Washington is named commander of the Continental Army. June 17. The Patriots and the British fight at the Battle of Bunker Hill. 1776. March 17. The Siege of Boston ends with a victory for the Patriots. June 20. Benjamin Talmadge joins the Continental Army in Connecticut. July 3. The British begin the invasion of New York City. July 4. The Declaration of Independence is adopted. August 27. The Battle of Long Island. September 22. Nathan Hale is hanged as a spy. December 25 to 26. Washington and his army cross the Delaware River and capture Trenton, New Jersey. 1777. December 19. General Washington establishes his winter camp in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. 1778, February 6, France agrees to provide supplies and troops to fight alongside the Patriots. June 18, the British abandon Philadelphia and move troops to New York. June 18, the Battle of Rhode Island. Late summer, Benjamin Talmadge recruits the first members of the Culper spy ring. November 23, Abraham Woodall writes his first letter to General Washington. 1779. May. Benedict Arnold first contacts British General Clinton. Summer. Robert Townsend joins the ring. September. The mysterious agent 355 is recruited. November 27. The ring exposes the British counterfeiting plot. Rivington throws in his lot with the Patriots. 1780. July 11. French troops land in Rhode Island. September 25. Information gathered by the ring exposes Benedict Arnold as a traitor. October 2. John André is hanged. 1782. February 27. The British House of Commons votes to end all offensive actions against the colonists. 1783. September 3. The British government formally acknowledges the United States of America. Thousands of loyalists leave to settle in Canada or England. November 25. Washington rides into Manhattan as the victor as the last British ships leave the harbor. This is Stephen Graybill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of George Washington's Secret Six, The Spies Who Saved America, by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. This program was directed by Francis Loy, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2019 by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.